I'm Michael McCusker. Saturday is the day, it's the 80th anniversary of the Great Pacific Coast Maritime Strike, which in 1934 was a Thursday, and it was called Bloody Thursday as a result of that strike, which I wish to read about. And it's something I wrote, so I guess I have to give the disclaimer that this is my opinion and my opinion only, and perhaps all of the cosmos and universities and universes. And also, I quote a great deal from a fellow named Michael Quinn from his book, The Great Strike. Bloody Thursday, the Great Pacific Coast Maritime Strike. 80 years ago this summer, San Francisco was paralyzed by the largest general strike staged by labor unions in this country. It started as a maritime strike in the spring of 1934 when thousands of longshoremen, stevedores as they were often called, walked off the job because they were sick of bad pay and humiliating treatment. They were joined by seamen, teamsters, and other maritime unions, and through unanimous action closed the port of San Francisco for more than 2 months. No ship was loaded or unloaded. No cargo was moved off the docks. In sympathy with the strikers, longshoremen went out on strike in Seattle, Tacoma, Bellingham, Aberdeen, Gray's Harbor, Portland, Astoria, Stockton, Los Angeles, San Diego, and all other Pacific Coast ports. The strike was a bloody one. Pickets, strikers, that's the term for them in those days, and police fought bitter pitched battles with guns, gas, and clubs arrayed against rocks, bricks, and fists. The Industrial Association, a group of shipowners, presidents of stevedoring companies and other maritime executives, made itself San Francisco's legal authority and continually attempted to open the port with scabs and police, and through hysterical newspaper and radio accounts that labeled the strikers as communists and aliens, which many were. But no matter where they came from or what they believed in, the strikers sought justice and resisted all attempts to outmaneuver them or force them back to work with nothing settled. The battles grew in ferocity until at the beginning of July, they were as savage as a war. On July 3rd, which was at the time the 70th anniversary of Pickett's charge at Gettysburg, and of course is today's date, thousands of strikers and police fought all day. The July 4 holiday provided a truce, and the day passed peaceably. But in the early morning of Thursday, July 5th, the fighting resumed where it had left off, when police and scabs attempted once more to open the port. Two strikers were shot to death by police revolvers, and several hundred suffered pistol wounds. Hundreds more were hospitalized or dragged into hiding after they were injured by gas and clubs. Mike Quinn, who was a participant of the 1934 maritime strike and a close associate of the strike leader, an Australian stevedore named Harry Bridges, wrote an account of Bloody Thursday in his book, The Big Strike. At 8 a.m. promptly, the police went into action, Quinn wrote. Tear gas bombs were hurled into the picket lines and the police charged with their clubs. Gasping and choking, the strikers were driven back to the alleys off the Embarcadero or retreated up Rincon Hill. Shots rang out as police opened fire with revolvers. Flying bricks and bullets crashed windows. Tear gas sent workers in nearby factory and office buildings swarming into the streets. The whole area was swept by a surf of fighting men. Quinn quoted a newspaper. The hottest battle took place in front of the ILA, International Longshoremen's Association, now the ILWU, International Longshoremen's and Warehousemen's Union, on Stewart Street, where scores were gassed, clubbed, and shot. Police cars literally filled the headquarters with gas from long-range guns, and persons entrenched there poured from the doors. Quinn wrote that workers on the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge, then under construction, were forced to abandon the job for the day because of stray bullets whistling around their heads. Police charged into the Seaboard Hotel, Quinn continued, where many strikers were quartered and drove all occupants into the streets, swinging their long riot sticks and cracking skulls right and left. The building was filled with gas and riddled with pistol fire. Stubbornly holding their ground and fighting every inch of the way, the strikers were driven back into the city and off the Embarcadero. The battle swept over into the busy downtown district, endangering the crowds of pedestrians. One picket, striker, entrenched himself in a parking lot, devised a crude slingshot from an old inner tube, and began bombarding Chief of Police William J. Quinn's, no relation to Quinn the writer, car with bricks. It took a barrage of tear gas and pistol fire to dislodge him. A badly wounded man laying on the pavement cursed the police and refused to allow them to remove him. Later he was taken to a hospital in a private car. Scores of men littered the sidewalks, either lying silently or crawling away painfully on their hands and knees. A woman alighting from a streetcar at the ferry building screamed and collapsed when the bullet struck her in the temple. A man rushed to her assistance, was struck by another bullet, and crumpled to the street beside her. A Chronicle reporter described women who had been shopping in downtown stores arrived at the Loop to step into an inferno. With screaming children clinging to them, they disembarked from the cars to find themselves in clouds of smarting tear gas. Guns cracked. Men fell screaming as they went down. Police clubs cracked against skulls, smothered and blinded by gas. The women and children staggered about helplessly. Policemen grabbed them as fast as possible and sent them to a hospital, where they were horrified by the sight of men dripping with blood, moaning from bullet wounds and injuries. And that was a Quinn quoting a Chronicle reporter. And I continue with Quinn. People in surrounding buildings were driven out by gas, and many were winged by stray shots as they fled. At the height of the battle, a delegation from the strike committee, headed by Harry Bridges, called on Mayor Angelo J. Rossi to protest. The mayor simply repeated what acting California Governor Frank Merriam, had said earlier, "You refuse to arbitrate, now take the consequences." Hospitals were put on a wartime basis to accommodate the wounded. At the morgue, covered over by white sheets, were two cold, quiet bodies. Howard Sperry and Nicholas Bourdois, or Bourdos, however you want to pronounce it, his name. The striking unions had men detailed to the hospitals to see that wounded pickets received adequate attention when brought in from the battlefield. These men reported later that injured strikers were threatened and intimidated by police when they stated that their club and gunshot wounds were caused by officers. At the close of the day, Acting Governor Merriam ordered the National Guard onto the waterfront. 2,000 troops marched into the area equipped with rapid-fire guns, machine guns, gas equipment, and bayoneted rifles. By the time they arrived, the fighting had ceased and the pickets had been driven from the Embarcadero. The guardsmen posted themselves at intervals down the whole length of the waterfront and mounted machine guns on the roofs of piers. Troops marched in wearing steel helmets and full service equipment. They set up camp inside the long, covered docks, established field kitchens, and remained there under wartime conditions. Divisions were brought in from Santa Rosa, Napa, Petaluma, Gilroy, and other outlying towns. Rumors were abundant to the effect that certain units had refused service, but strict censorship was maintained and definite confirmations were lacking. All day long, newspapers uptown had been pouring out extra after extra, delivering veritable hourly reports from the line of battle. Wailing sirens careening up and down Market Street aroused speculation and alarm among the public. The word blood, blood, blood recurred every three or four lines in every news story. So much blood had been seen that it obsessed the minds of news writers, and the word was repeated again and again, almost involuntarily, as they typed their copy. Reporters had been in the thick of the fighting all day long. Many had bruised limbs and minor injuries to help them remember. These hurts soon healed and passed away, but an experience, a reality, was impressed in their minds that would never wear away and would affect their ideas, their decisions, and their loyalties for the rest of their lives. The strikers named the day Bloody Thursday. And that was Michael Quinn from his book, the big strike. On Monday, July 9, 1934, a funeral march was held for Howard Sperry and Nicolas Bourdois, or Bourdois. 40,000 men, women, and children marched in silence, 8 and 10 abreast the length of Market Street, behind trucks that carried the two coffins and flowers. A union band played a funeral march by Beethoven. A newspaper described the procession as a river of men flowing up Market Street like cooling lava, solemn strains of dirges and hymns, uncountable thousands of spectators lining the streets with uncovered heads. Overhead, a brilliant sun in a cloudless sky. Another newspaper said that the two dead strikers in life wouldn't have commanded a second glance on the streets of San Francisco, but in death they were borne the length of Market Street in a stupendous and reverent procession that astounded the city. A week later, a general strike was declared in San Francisco, and the city was effectively shut down for 3 days. For all practical purposes, Mike Quinn wrote, not a wheel moved or a lever budged. The official reaction was hysteria. The general strike was confused with revolution. Rumors in newspapers claimed that a communist army was marching on the city from the north. Northwesterners were thought to be communists and radicals because of strong IWW activity the preceding decade. 500 extra policemen were hired and thousands more National Guardsmen were sent to San Francisco from all over California. Police red squads raided strikers' homes and union offices. Vigilantes attacked and beat striking workers that they accused of being communists. The maritime strike ended in late July 1934 and the port of San Francisco was reopened. The maritime unions were awarded recognition. Contracts were signed and demands were met or promised to be met through arbitration, among them the crucial issue of hiring halls to be controlled by the unions and a ban on blacklisting strikers from employment. Longshore pay was raised and dockside hours shortened. But all this did not bring peace to the waterfront, Mike Quinn wrote several years later. Instead, there ensued a period of industrial guerrilla warfare, which persisted for more than 2 years, ultimately resulting in the whole Pacific Coast maritime strike breaking out again in greater force than ever, the Great Maritime Strike of 1936. The Great Pacific Coast Maritime Strike of 1934 was the harbinger of future labor battles in steel, auto, rubber, and other smokestack industries in the United States. It heralded the vast organizing drives that gave birth to the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, which later became affiliated with the American Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO. And it set an example of militant solidarity that proved beneficial to other unions in the great labor struggles of the 1930s. The 1934 strike is memorable because, above all, it demonstrated the power latent in the rank and file, Harry Bridges said a few years later. The rank and file not only manned the picket lines and did the sacrificing, as it must in every strike, but it also made the big decisions and determined the strategy. The rank and file wouldn't be bulldozed or buffaloed, browbeaten or divided, and therefore it couldn't be licked. Once it knew the score, the rank and file could not be misled by any phony labor leader or panicked by any barrage of newspaper propaganda. Bridges said that, ultimately, the power of any union that serves as an instrumentality of the workers rests on the courage and conviction in its ranks. That is one fundamental truth that has not altered since 1934, nor will it alter in times to come. We've had strikes on the waterfront since 1934, Bridges said, but never again have the bosses dared to shoot our men down in cold blood. For many years after Bloody Thursday, each July 5th was commemorated by maritime workers who took unauthorized days off to march once again by the thousands up Market Street in honor of the two dead strikers. One ship owner bitterly complained that on every July 5th there is a complete cessation of work up and down the whole Pacific coast because of a holiday declared by the unions for the purpose of commemorating a day of violence and bloodshed. No one authorizes the July 5th holiday excepting a 100% accord of the entire maritime profession, Mike Quinn wrote in The Big Strike, which was first published in 1949, 13 years after he wrote it and 2 years after his death at 41. Therefore, he wrote, it is regarded as a completely unauthorized stoppage of work and an illegal act. The maritime unions have nothing by which to defend this annual disregard for authority, other than an old, almost forgotten phrase in the yellow documents of the Revolution of 1776, which reads, by the consent of the governed. And that was Bloody Thursday, the Great Pacific Coast Maritime Strike. And I'd like to read something else which I wrote, which the disclaimer still holds, for life and liberty. Once again, the United States of America is in need of a revolution to thwart incipient tyranny and the blatant attempt by a consortium of robber barons and corrupt politicos, whom the framers of the Constitution warned us against, from seizing control of the feeble remnants of government that operate on the behalf of the people. This necessary revolution is underwritten in the nation's principles and is as sweeping in its implications as the original revolt against English rule, which was as corrupt, despotic, and hubristic as the American government has deformed into the past few decades. This revolution is within the law. It is supported by the law, in design, if seldom in practice. And the law not only provides its mechanics, the law in a very real sense depends on it to maintain its integrity. This revolution is more binding than the ancient right to remove emperors in old China or revolt against kings and church in medieval Europe. This revolution is the vote. Guaranteed after intense struggle and diverse constitutional amendments to all citizens, which too many more abuse by disuse than misuse. On average, less than 50% of eligible voters in this country vote. Disgust and perceived powerlessness, not apathy, alienate millions of citizens from the polls and are major sources of great public discontent that affects even those who do vote but are discouraged and fed up. That discontent might be tapped by concentrating on registering to vote the many millions who have either dropped out of the political process or have never been given much opportunity or incentive to participate in it. If these millions of ordinary people were to rise from their bitter cynicism and phlegmatic despair and use nothing more than their constitutional right to vote, they will discover they have the power to transform much of which has gone off track in our recent history. It is time to recognize that the heart of our liberty is disappearing in the despair of the deprived and disenfranchised. Non-voters are generally economically impaired and suffer most from inequities and corruption, with little chance of prosperity in the existing status quo. Yet the potential of real power lies within these disaffected masses. There are more genuine, emphasis on genuine, grassroots organizations that in any time in the nation's history, all waiting for a real chance to voice their concerns, issues, and visions. All politics are local, while the trend seems to favor high-pressure political professionals funded by large amounts of money, which increasingly fragments the electorate with nasty advertising and big bucks-backed candidates, whose sponsors are now granted anonymity. They remain vulnerable to the populism of grassroots campaigning organized at the neighborhood level in every community in the USA. We have allowed the vote to be trivialized and made much less than its true potency. Money has been granted equal to free speech and elections without disclosure of its source. The cash that candidates accept supersedes the vote, which is treated as a commodity to be purchased and virtually ensures their continuance in office. Securely established incumbents count on fewer people to vote to maintain power and on ever larger contributions from wealthy and corporate sponsors who use their money to turn campaigns into public ordeals of fear and loathing. Paradoxically, as almost direct cause and effect, fewer Americans voting cheapens the vote as well as makes it cheaper to purchase. Not voting is a virtual assurance those who do not vote will remain powerless as they become increasingly victimized. The most necessary The next most necessary thing we must do is ensure that our votes count, which means demanding verification of our votes. The best way to do that is replace suspiciously tamper-prone high-tech voting machines with paper ballots, which is the method most world democracies continue to use because it is the most reliable. Paper ballots are counted by people, not by machines. There are no patent liabilities or proprietary claims involved in the process of hand-counting votes, and the checks and balances and rechecks to ensure the accuracy and honesty of counting ballots are required by law. And ultimately, as with juries, the people who count ballots regard their task with grave responsibility, a weighty, passionate, and essential sense of the obligation of citizenship that machinery does not feel. People can, of course, be manipulated and corrupted, but never so easily as machines, especially technology designed and marketed by the very political, corporate, military fraternity that has most to gain from rigging elections. Oregon currently uses optical scan election systems to count the state's mail-in ballots. The Oregon Voter Rights Coalition, which was formed after the 2004 election, in which 98% of Oregon's votes were tabulated on voting machines manufactured by the very corporations implicated in nationwide computer voting fraud, says that it is necessary for every voter to be informed about the facts of voting machine use and the possibility of corruption. Suggestions to reduce the possibility of fraud include the demand that corporations and politicians get out of counting the votes, and that's a quote. Also, that open-source election software be used for transparency, as well as the use of scientifically designed election verification processes. Methods of ensuring election integrity incorporate logic and accuracy tests, audits of precincts, county-wide and or statewide verification, and recounts of votes by hand-counting all paper ballots for races that are in doubt. Other suggestions are that volunteer groups take up poll watching and that election returns be posted at the precinct level. Retain ballots in voting machines in which they are counted for documentation. Publicly display results in precincts because the audit trail gets lost once they are transmitted to centralized counting sites. Most importantly, the Oregon Voter Rights Coalition exhorts voters to not let elections go unchallenged. We do not have a political system that presents us with the best choices our country is capable of offering. The insular filtration process of just two political parties screens out nearly everybody qualified for public office and is so ripe for constitutional infidelity that it extensively awards a gluttonous minority over the interests of everybody else. The nation's political and economic structure needs massive and real change to transfer power and wealth back to the majority of ordinary citizens who are the true leaders of democracy. Despite the partisan squalor, chiefly by the neo-know-nothings of this era, aka the Tea Party and its predatory right-wing manipulators, this November midterm election might possibly be a restart in that direction. And that was something I wrote for Life and Liberty. And I'd like to read something again that I wrote. Flags Passing By. Whenever an American flag is unfurled, I feel that I am a stranger instead of a citizen. I don't dislike the flag. I just feel that flag wavers and I live in separate countries. Flags are everywhere. In public places, of course, but they bloom also from houses, offices, automobiles, stenciled on T-shirts and worn as lapel pins. These persistent and nagging proclamations of Americanhood, which might appear reasonable, though rude, in a foreign country, seem discriminatory and shabbily neurotic here at home. I am sure that most people who feel a compulsion to mark themselves with a flag believe in freedom and democracy for themselves and those they regard as like themselves, but I doubt they feel the same passion about the rights and liberties of others who practice a different religion, or none, or who have a different skin color, or are recent immigrants. The flag conceals more than it illuminates. Its red stripes represent the blood shed by the early patriots who, if anyone needs to be reminded, were traitors. The stars are symbols of conquest, the brutal displacement of one civilization by another. Some citizens veil themselves with flags, merging self-perceived inadequacies with the civic inequities and empirical ambitions disguised by fervent nationalism. Underneath the patriotic bunting can be sensed the grim frenzy and unforgiving intolerance for new ideas and those who engage in them. The Pledge Allegiance to the Flag that children must say every day in public schools, which contains the phrase, "One Nation Under God," is the national school prayer. A flag is, after all, a tribal totem, relatively unsophisticated in an expanding global civilization in which such iconoclastic relics of humanity's immaturity should only be displayed in museums. Yet people still do get upset when someone trods upon a flag or blows a nose on its stars and stripes. Making shirts of flags or burning them in public protests gives police and some military veterans, not all, apoplexy. Patriots, poor, confused souls who think their personal lives would improve if the United States dominated the earth, roar with anger and anguish because desecrating the flag is protected by the Constitution's guarantee of free speech and is in character with the precepts of democracy. A piece of cloth, whatever its mythological imperative, is not to be placed above human rights. What is freedom worth if in dissent against its loss, its symbols cannot be dramatically abused? Symbols are powerful. They define purpose, hold people together, but separate them also. Humanity is crossbreeding at an incredible rate. Primitive icons of separateness are increasingly meaningless. Our species will truly be free when it is able to abandon the symbols that perpetuate its divisions. The many tribes no longer need their special banners and bunting, except as family talismans put away for memory. I do not participate in flag ceremonies or attend parades in which legions of flags are marched past me. For a few years, I was obliged to salute the flag twice a day during its raising and lowering. And when I was at war for the flag, I dreaded it would swaddle my corpse. I would not spit on the flag because I don't think a flag is that important. Why should anyone care if someone burns a flag or makes love on one? And I'd like to finish up with something again that I wrote. Sons of Liberty. And I'd like to dedicate it to Janet Stevenson, who really liked this little piece, and I'm very happy she did. 238 years ago, on July 2nd, 1776, a small group of terrorists betrayed their country and voted to commit any and all acts of terror and treason which they claimed would be necessary to separate from their government. 2 days later, on July 4th, they publicly declared their intention of betrayal and categorically stated their reasons for turning against their country and threatened to murder or otherwise terrorize all who did not join with them. They began their terrorist acts several years earlier. They burned, looted, tortured, murdered, kidnapped, and held hostage representatives and supporters of their government. They ambushed and killed soldiers and policemen. Several attempts at negotiations only increased their demands and brutality until finally the previous year, in April 1775, they committed open rebellion by attacking government forces that had been sent to protect loyal citizens from their terrorism. The terrorists cloaked their atrocities and treachery with a specious document that claimed the sanction of God and the sympathy of humanity. They named their perfidious document a Declaration of Independence. Tomorrow is what we consider the Day of Independence. But like I think I said earlier, it's the press release, an incredible press release, not to say the least. But the real day of secession was yesterday. And that's been 238 years. And today is the day in between those. So when you do pop off the firecrackers and fireworks tomorrow, not only remember that fireworks are to simulate warfare, but also to remind us what we had to fight for to get what we got and what we are seriously in threat of losing.